"How are you?" I asked. He didn't answer. He was looking through the window of the intensive care unit at the sandbox in the hospital garden. His eyes were vacant, the way I found them when I pulled him out of the bathtub. I reached into the paper bag between my feet and I took out the copy of the Shahnameh I'd bought at a Persian bookstore. "I used to read this to your father when we were children. We'd go up the hill by our house and sit under the pomegranate tree. His favorite was the story of Rustam and Sohrab. That's how you got your name. I know you know that." I paused, feeling like an idiot. "Anyway, he said in his letter that it was your favorite too. Shall I read to you?" Sohrab covered his eyes with his arm. "I am so tired. Tired of everything. What can I do, Sohrab? I want my old life back. I want father and mother. I want to play with Rahim Khan in the garden." I didn't know what to say, where to look. "I wish you had left me in the water." "Oh, Sohrab." I leaned forward to touch his shoulder, and he flinched. I dropped my hand, remembering ruefully how in the days before I'd broken my promise to him, he had finally become at ease with my touch. "Sohrab, I can't give you your old life back. I wish to God I could. But I can take you with me. You have a visa to go to America to live with me and my wife. It's true. I promise." He sighed. I wished I hadn't said those last two words. "You know, I've done a lot of things I regret in my life. And maybe none more than going back on the promise I made you. But that will never happen again. I am so profoundly sorry. I ask for your forgiveness. Can you do that? Can you believe me? Will you come with me?" Sohrab rolled on his side and said quietly, "I am so very tired." In the end, he never accepted my offer. What I took as a yes was in actuality more of a quiet surrender by one too weary to decide and far too tired to believe. And so it was that about a week later, I brought Hassan's son from Afghanistan to America. If someone were to ask me today whether the story of Hassan, Sohrab, and me ends with happiness, I wouldn't know what to say. We arrived home about 7 months ago. Saraya picked us up at the airport. I'd never been away from her for so long, and when I smelled apples in her hair, I realized how much I had missed her. After she knelt to eye level with Sohrab, she took his hand and smiled at him. Sohrab shifted on his feet and looked away. Saraya had turned the study upstairs into a bedroom. She led Sohrab in and he sat on the edge of the bed. The sheet showed brightly colored kites flying in indigo blue sky. At the foot of the bed was a wicker basket stuffed with toys and books. Sohrab looked at it impassively. Saraya asked if he liked his room. He lowered his head, said nothing. Then he simply laid his head on the pillow, and less than 5 minutes later he was asleep. Sohrab didn't so much live with us as occupy space, and precious little of it. Sometimes at the market or in the park, I noticed how other people hardly seemed to see him. He moved as if not to stir the air around him. Mostly, he slept. Sohrab's silence was hard on Saraya. Over the long-distance line to Pakistan, she told me about the things she was planning for him. Swimming classes, soccer. Now she'd walk past his room and catch a glimpse of books sitting unopened. Jigsaw puzzles unmade. While Sohrab was silent, the world was not. One Tuesday morning, the Twin Towers came crumbling down, and overnight the world changed. Soon after the attacks, America bombed Afghanistan. The Northern Alliance moved in, and the Taliban scurried like rats into the caves. Suddenly people were standing in grocery stores talking about the cities of my childhood. Kandahar, Herat, Mazar-i-Sharif. Surab sleepwalked through it all. Then 4 days ago, on a cool rainy weekend in March, a small wondrous thing happened. I took Soraya and Surab to a gathering of Afghans at the park. The previous week had been the Afghan New Year. We arrived around noon. Someone was already frying balani. Steam rose from teacups. A scratchy old Amir Zahir song was blaring from a cassette player. It had been raining, and we rushed across the soggy grass into the shelter of a makeshift tent. Surab only stayed under the canopy for a moment and then stepped back into the rain, hands stuffed in the pockets of his raincoat, his hair plastered against his scalp. No one seemed to notice. With time, the queries about our adopted and decidedly eccentric little boy had mercifully eased. People stopped asking why he never spoke, why he didn't play with the other kids. I shook hands with Kabir, a silver-haired man who introduced me to a dozen others who'd all known Baba. In one way or another, he touched all their lives. They said I was lucky to have had such a great man for a father. Someone lightened a barbecue, and the smell of lamb kebab flooded my senses. Soraya pulled on my sleeve. Amir, look! She was pointing in the air. A half dozen kites were flying high against the gray sky. A man was selling them from a stand nearby. I walked over and pointed to a yellow one. He handed me the kite and a wooden spool of glass tar. I tested the string the way Hassan and I used to, by holding it between my thumb and forefinger. The seller smiled. I took the kite to where Sarab was standing. "Do you like it?" I asked, holding it up by the end of the crossbar. His eyes shifted from the sky to me, to the kite, then back. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Soraya watching us from the tent, hands tensely dug in her armpits. I wet my index finger and held it up. "I remember the way your father checked the wind was to kick up the dust with his sandal. See which way the wind blew it." He knew a lot of little tricks like that. Surab wiped a raindrop from his earlobe, shifted on his feet. "Did I ever tell you your father was the best kite runner in all of Kabul? How jealous he made the neighborhood kids? He'd run kites and never look up at the sky, and people used to say he was chasing the kite shadow. But they didn't know him, like I did. Your father wasn't chasing shadows. He just knew." Another half dozen kites had taken flight. People had started to gather in clumps, teacups in hands, eyes glued to the sky. "Do you want to help me fly it?" Sarab's gaze bounced from the kite to me. "Okay," I shrugged. "Looks like I'll have to fly it solo." I balanced the spool in my left hand and fed about 3 feet of tar. The yellow kite dangled at the end of it, just above the wet grass. "Last chance. All right, here I go." I took off, running, the hand clutching the kite end of the string held high above my head. I let the spool roll in my left hand. The kite was lifting behind me now, lifting and wheeling. I ran harder, then stopped and turned. High above, my kite was tilting side to side, making that old flapping sound I always associated with winter mornings in Kabul. I hadn't flown a kite for a quarter of a century, but suddenly I was 12 again, and all the old instincts came rushing back. I felt a presence next to me and looked down. It was Surab, hands dug deep in the pockets of his raincoat. He'd followed me. "Do you want to try?" I asked. He said nothing. But when I held the string out for him, his hand lifted from his pocket, hesitated, took the string. We stood quietly, side by side, necks bent up. Then I saw we had company. A green kite was closing in. I traced the string to a kid standing about 30 yards from us. He saw me looking and waved. I smiled. "Okay, let's teach him a lesson." The glassy, vacant look in Sarab's eyes was gone. His gaze flitted between our kite and the green one, his eyes suddenly alive. I wondered when I'd forgotten that despite everything, he was still just a child. The green kite was making its move. "Let's wait," I said. "Let him get a little closer." The kite dipped twice and crept towards us, suddenly rising above us, unaware of the trap I'd set. "Watch, Sarab. I'm going to show you one of your father's favorite tricks." Next to me, Sarab gripped the spool. And just for a moment, I saw the calloused hands of a hare-lipped boy. The park shimmered with snow, so fresh, so dazzling white, it burnt my eyes. I smelled dried mulberries, sour oranges. The green kite hovered directly above us, held position, then shot down. "Here he comes." I did it perfectly. After all these years, the old lift and dive trap. I loosened my grip and tugged on the string, dipping and dodging the green kite. A series of quick sidearm jerks and our kite shot up counterclockwise in a half circle. Suddenly I was on top. The green kite was scrambling now, panic-stricken. But it was too late. I pulled hard and our kite plummeted. I could almost feel our string sawing his. Almost heard the snap. Then just like that, the green kite was spinning and wheeling out of control. Behind us, people cheered. The last time I'd felt a rush like this was that day in the winter of 1975 when I spotted Baba on our rooftop, clapping, beaming. I looked down at Sarab. One corner of his mouth had curled up. A smile. Lopsided, but there. Behind us, a melee of screaming kite runners was chasing the loose kite. I blinked, and the smile had gone. But it had been there. I'd seen it. "Do you want me to run that kite for you?" He swallowed. I thought I saw him nod. "For you, 1,000 times over, I heard myself say. Then I turned and ran. It was only a smile. Nothing more. It didn't make everything all right. It was just a leaf in the woods, shaking in the wake of a startled bird's flight. But I'll take it, with open arms. Because when spring comes, it melts the snow one flake at a time. And maybe I just witnessed the first flake melting. I ran. A grown man, running with a swarm of screaming children. But I didn't care. I ran with the wind blowing in my face and a smile as wide as the valley of Panjshir on my lips. I ran.